The books, the books! Come on! They're right behind you! Hi, are you late? You guys asked me. Okay.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, but you got to do that. So I can lean out. Page 1255. Why would you think it says? Yeah. Okay, so Haman has decided that he's going to destroy the entire Jewish people as a means to get at Mordechai, who he believes is shaming him in public. So, starting with verse 8, which really is a new paragraph. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is one people. Now, scattered and detached. That's what the words literally mean. The fazer means to scatter things, and farad, nifrad, means detached. To understand what those two things mean. Among the peoples in all the states or provinces of your realm, and their laws, customs, are different from every people, and the laws of the king they don't do. The king, for the king, it's not worthwhile to tolerate, it's not a bad word here, tolerate them. If it'll be good for the king, let it be written to destroy them, another passive verb, let it be written. Not you should write, or he should write, but let it be written. And 10,000 silver coins of some kind or other, I know they say talents, let's say, because you don't know what it means. Nobody knows what a talent is. I will weigh out via the workers, those who are in charge of the work, to bring to the treasure house of the king. Now let's understand his plot here, and let's understand what he thinks is significant to say to the king, and in particular the order of the things he says. He wants to destroy these people. Notice he doesn't even name them. Doesn't even name them. The name doesn't matter. It's the description. And this description is supposed to motivate Ahasuerus to agree to destroy them. I remember that this guy, Ahasuerus, is desperate for his honor and for his glory and for people to love him and appreciate him. Desperate for their support. He's always worried about his security and worried about his popularity. So what does he say? First of all, this people is scattered. They have no concentrated power base. They themselves can't mount resistance because they're scattered. Wherever they are minorities. Number two, they're detached. They have no allies. So that an attack on them is not going to generate a response from somebody else. Mufuzar means scattered. Mufurad means detached. They're detached from everybody else. Which was exactly right about the Jewish people at that time. And it was right, not only externally, but internally. In other words, he saw the external. But the external is always a reflection of the internal. And they are scattered everywhere. They're everywhere. Which means that their capacity to do mischief is very widespread. They can be a communications network, from one part of the kingdom to the other. Now watch. Their laws are different from the laws of every people, and they don't do the king's laws. That order is very strange, isn't it? You're trying to motivate the king to be upset with them, angry at them, and willing to wipe them out. Wouldn't you start with the fact that they don't keep the king's laws? Listen, they don't listen to you. They don't obey your laws. And they're also... No. First he starts with they're different from everybody else. Which means that you can count on the fact that nobody likes them. Nobody likes them. They're different and set apart from, distinct from everybody else. So don't worry when you attack them. Not only don't they have any allies, but nobody likes them. And finally he comes to the king himself. Finally, and they don't keep your laws. You should know that. That's an important thing. You know, you don't keep your laws. But if he started off, they don't keep your laws, the king wouldn't see that as a significant factor. After all, didn't we just see in the previous paragraph that when Mordechai doesn't bow down, and that's violating the king's law, what's the king's attitude? That's a Jewish custom. We don't have laws to force you to break your customs. No, it's perfectly all right. If that's your country's way of doing things, you don't have to keep the king's laws. So you can't motivate this man by saying that they're rebels against the king. What do you mean rebels? He's just keeping his own customs. But if you start by motivating him that these are people who have no allies and no power base, and they're already, people don't like them because they set themselves apart and are different from everybody else, then you can interest him that these are people who you can attack with impunity and even with a certain amount of support, others who don't like them. Now, he says, if it's good for the king, if the king's judgment will agree, let it be written to destroy them. And I will give you 10,000 coins of silver. Now, those who don't know the text, what do you guess is going to be the king's response to the offer of a bribe? Given what I told you last week.
Money.
Huh?
He has a lot of money. He doesn't need a bribe.
Correct. Number one, he certainly doesn't need a bribe. And more than that,
he's the king. He can do what he wants.
More than that, nobody remembers what we said the first day.
He wants to. He listens to the law.
The king doesn't have to worry about taking bribes. No. He is the law, right?
No, but he listened to his advisor.
Okay, but more though, what did we say about the party?
To show that since he's rich.
He's not worried about the Jews because they can't vote the
basement. All this is true, but the point here about the bribe is what he said. Why did he show off his wealth at the party?
He's insecure.
Say again?
He's insecure.
Yes, that's true, but what will this help his insecurity? In what way will this build him up? What do we say?
To show
you
no one can bribe him.
Right. To show that he's above bribes. To show that he's independently wealthy. A man who's king and doesn't have wealth, you're always afraid that somebody will bribe him and turn him to do something else. So listen, I'm going to be a good king. You can trust me. You can count on me. When I say something, it'll happen because nobody can push me around. Nobody can bribe me. Now here comes Haman offering him a bribe.
Why
are
you proceeding king
who's responsible? What's that?
Why you perceive king's response for it over the
rug? Well, think now psychologically. You state a proposition and you wait. When would you offer the bribe? And he says no. And he says no. He says, okay, well, listen, I'll give you money. But once a person's already said no, it's much harder because now you've got him to change his mind. Furthermore, you make it obvious that he's doing it only for the money. Here, we give him five reasons, one of which is a bribe. Number one, he hasn't taken the opposite position yet. Number two, who can say that it was the money that was so important? But the king surely is going to reject the bribe. Because this will ruin his credibility. Right? So I don't know whether Haman made a mistake here, or whether Haman sort of projected himself into the king's shoes and said, boy, if they offered me this money, I don't care about my principles, I'd certainly take it. I don't know what exactly was Haman's calculation here, or whether he made a miscalculation, but as you will see, of course the king rejects the bribe, because that will undermine his whole drive to support his popularity on the grounds that he's above being bribed. Yeah.
Where did Cohen get the money to be able to bribe the king?
You know, often people in a kingdom are richer than the king. Often the king has to depend on... The kings were kings by virtue of blood. Now, as they have a king who's a gambler, and he wastes away the royal fortune. So then, you know, his child, when he becomes king, may not have very much money. The fact that you're king doesn't mean you have a lot of money. Anyway.
Get his money.
Okay. Okay. I'm just talking about what's in the text. He was rich. He was able to do it. So this is the argument. Now the king's response, verse 10, we're up to. King took off his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, son of Dasa, the enemy of the Jews. You know what a signet ring is for? You know what that is? Signet ring. Put the wax in. You put this ring in it, and it leaves a mark. And that's how you know that it comes from the king. Now, watch what he does, this king. He gives him the ring. And the king said to Haman, the silver is given to you. I don't want your bribe. It's the first thing he says. Don't give me bribes. And the people also, to do with as you see fit. So what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that Haman is going to write the letters, write the decree, and seal it with the king's seal. Why? Why is the king doing it that way?
So the king doesn't have any responsibility.
He didn't do it. He trusted his prime minister. Suppose it turns out badly. So you can always say, you know, he's prime minister, so I trusted his judgment, and maybe indeed. It's like, you know, all these crooks, these politicians, they go, oh, I didn't know, you know, I trusted him. It was his idea. I mean, who about, you know, what they call a Teflon president, you know, nothing sticks to him. And then you throw mud and he just washes off because he can always say, I didn't know. So this, again, is, you know, he's clever. You want this project? Yeah, I agree it's good for me, but you do it. Put my signatory on it, so that way it'll be official, but I'm not... And in a way, maybe that's what Haman hinted at, because he said, Yikas save la'abdam, let it be written to destroy them. He didn't say, you should write it. He made it very impersonal. Let it be written. So the king says, okay, let it be written, but I'm not writing it.
Saying, you go write the letters, bring the letters back to me, and I'll stamp them with this ring. Instead, he's saying, here's the ring, you know, in the meantime...
He wants to be able to say later, he didn't see it. This private, it's a private conversation, he gives him the ring, and then he goes off and does this. That's right. If it works out, it works out. If it doesn't work out, then he can say, you know, I didn't mean it that way, he didn't check the details with me.
I want this guy to go and write something that he wants to be done. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give him my ring. I'm going to wait for him to come back with those documents so I can seal them.
Only if you want to be the author of the... Then you might as well write them yourself.
But then why is it not like a public acquisition of this ring, saying, like, go take the ring and do what you want?
He is. He is saying that, but you can always say, I trusted the guy's judgment. And now, you know, if your son takes the car and he runs it into a wall, and you say, well, why did you run the car into the wall? I didn't, my son did. Well, did you get in the car? Yeah, I did. So then you ran into the wall. No, I didn't. I mean, it's true. Maybe I shouldn't have trusted my son. But he was driving the car when he went into the wall. Not I was driving the car, right? But if he's there and I'm sitting in the back seat and I'm telling him what to do as he drives, then I can't say that he was driving the car. Why? What other troubles? Well, do you think he's going to write other letters in addition to sign them with a seal with the seal? I think that's unrealistic with the king's ring. Anyway, so the king's secretaries were summoned, another passive verb, on the 13th day of the first month. So now we're on the 13th of Nisan, 2 days before Pesach. And everything is written exactly as Haman had dictated.
Yeah.
What does it say over there? Sofrei. Yeah, I don't know why it says secretaries. Yeah, secretaries. This is a fanciful translation. What can I say? You're right. I should really translate it from the Hebrew. Why am I translating? Why am I reading English? Yeah, the scribes of the king were called in the first month, 13th day, and it was written. Passive verb. Not they wrote. Of course they wrote it, but no, it was written according to everything that Haman commanded. Two. Now these are words in Greek, in Persian, which we don't really understand. Achashtar pnei hamelech. These are certain kinds of officials in every province, and the high officials, the governors, every people, and every province according to its own script, and every people according to its own language. In the name of the king, Achashverosh, it was written and sealed with the ring of the king. Now, I don't know if this was the standard procedure. You know, in America, there are laws that are passed by Congress. Maybe somebody knows. Does the Congress provide a Spanish translation of the laws, a French translation of the laws, for all the people in the country that don't speak English or don't speak English well?
Right. In California, Koreans, I think you're responsible to your own constituency.
Who, you mean the senator or the representative? But it wouldn't be an official translation of the basis of Congress.
Probably not.
Just a service to the people. Right? Here, the emperor himself provides translations, and in the script that everybody can read it his own way, and everybody has it in his own language, you know. But it's a disaster for education, as California found out and finally woke up and reversed the laws. If you're living in America, you make a living, you better speak English. You better not have all your classes in Spanish, because you're going to end up a second-class citizen. You're going to perpetuate it forever. It took them a generation, but they finally figured it out. But here, he provides everybody with his amount. Truth to be told, it's a pretty smart move, because you don't want anybody later to say, well, you wrote it in Persian, so we translated it into Greek, but it's a tricky business translating it into Greek. We thought it meant this, and you're telling us it meant that, so okay, but how are we supposed to know? So here he provides his own translations, even their own scripts, so that no one could say later that they didn't have the laws available to them. So in a way, it's a smart administrative move if you're running an empire. And The writings were sent, all passive, in the hand of the runners to all the provinces of the king to destroy, kill, annihilate all the Jews from young to old, children, women, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to take their property for possessions. Now, just think of Poland. Suppose Poland got a decree like that. We're wiping out all the Jews, we're taking all their property. How do you think Poland would feel? How did Poland feel? They were overjoyed. They were overjoyed. 10% of the population, whatever it was, wiped them out, take all their property. But this is going to be, since the Jews are scattered, detached, they have no allies, they have laws different from everybody else's laws, so nobody really cares for them. They're minorities everywhere, they have no power base, and you're going to wipe them out, and everybody else is going to take their property. This is going to be wildly popular. So Ahasuerus is risking nothing by this move. Indeed, he could gain by this move. Now, there is a little detail here, which will come up in a few minutes, and the Malbim makes a great deal out of this, which will help understand the story. To whom are these written? In 12 it says, These writings are going to the various officials. Going to the officials. Now, if you thought this is going to be on the billboards, if this is going to be on the notice boards, if this is going to be, you know, when the town crier goes through and washes these billboards up, you know, with the glue and puts them up for everybody to see, so why are you writing it to the officials? Everybody's going to see it. It's going to be every street corner. The officials don't need to get what's going to be, you know. You don't send by diplomatic pouch a message that's going to be on the evening news. So on the evening news, everybody will know it. Well, why does he have to get it in a diplomatic pouch? What? Inside the diplomatic pouch, probably a printout from CNN?
No one knew it.
You know? Huh?
No one knew
that. Oh, so we'll have to see. We'll have to see. Because the verses here are a little bit contradictory. And the Malbim has an interesting shot. Here it says, so far, it's going to the officials. And the message is to wipe out all the Jews. And take their property. Pashegin Aksav, he translates copies, it's a difficult word, to be given as a law in every province, revealed to all the peoples, to be ready for that day. Oh, now a new thing, revealed to all the peoples. But what is revealed to all the peoples? Only it says, to be ready for that day. So says the Malbim, there were really two letters. There were two letters. One letter went to the officials. The letter to the officials told the whole story. The story is, in 11 months, we're wiping out the Jews, taking their property. But that was a sealed document, a secret document going only to the officials. On the billboards was only the 13th of Adar. It's going to be a special day. Be ready. That's all. Something special is going to happen. Why did he do it that way? Because it's 11 months away. And if it will become public knowledge that there is the decree to annihilate the Jews might take countermeasures. Who knows but with their wealth they could bribe some people? Who knows but they could generate friends? Maybe they have debts that they need to collect. You don't want to stir up trouble. So he took a two-pronged approach. Number one, he sent out to all the officials, telling the whole story. And then on the billboards was only the 13th of Adar is going to be special. Let me just one second before I take your question. Watch how the continuation, the next two verses, three verses, bears this out. So, 15, the runners went out, pushed in haste with the word of the king, and the law was published immediately in the capital, in Shushan the capital. The king and Haman sat down to drink, and the city Shushan was bewildered. It was bewildered, confused. And Mordechai knew what was done, and Mordechai tore his clothes. Now, if you think that there is a public decree that in Adar, all the Jews are going to be killed, the city Shushan wouldn't be bewildered and confused. They would be overjoyed. They'd be having parties of celebration. And you wouldn't say, Mordechai knew what was done. Everybody knew. It was up on the billboards. What did Mordechai do? What did Mordechai know more than everybody else? So according to the Malbim, the shot comes out beautiful. Suddenly a sign goes up. 11 months from now, on the 13th of Adar, something's going to happen. Be ready. This is the capital. You'd expect in the capital, rumors go around. People have connections. People know things. And here, suddenly something goes up in the name of the king, and nobody knows what it is. So people are talking. What's going on? Nobody knows. That's why the city is bewildered. Mordechai knows that he's the only one who knows, because nobody knows. All the other letters went out, a sealed secret document only going to the rulers. Then the question comes out, how does he know? Either he knows because of Ruach HaKodesh or whatever it is. But this way, if you understand that there were two documents, one to the rulers giving all the details, and one to be published in all the in public to say only that the 13th of Adar is going to be a special day. Be ready. You understand why the things work out this way.
Why is it like the Hashem or the
Harav? I don't know. My guess is that these words might be taken in limited senses, and they want to make sure that it's absolutely clear, without any ambiguity, that it means to wipe out everything, without any mercy, without any second thoughts. But exactly what this nuances are, I don't know. Yeah.
Why 11 months? Why is it straight away? Why is it going there?
You know the answer to that. We read it last time.
I can't remember.
He cast lots. Haman cast lots, and that's when it came out. Came out 11 months later. So he did it, right? Now, you know, you could ask, why is he taking the risk of sending any documents now? Wait 9 months or so, you know, and then engineer it. Huh? Number one, he's very excited. He's doing this in a rage about Mordechai. And once he gets the king to agree, he doesn't want to wait lest the king change his mind. I'm going to talk about that when we get to the philosophical issues. We spoke about that. For them, Lot was either accident or magic, and for us, Lot is hashgacha pratis. It's a private thing. Yeah. Now, I'm just going to tell you, because it'll come up later, but since we're talking about the letters that were sent out, there's going to be a problem. There was a rule in the kingdom that when you send out a decree with the king's seal on it, it cannot be revoked. You cannot take it back. No, not even the king. Once it's gone out, it cannot be revoked. It's absolute. Now, therefore, the question will come up when they finally get the king to agree that he doesn't want the Jews to be killed. So he says, okay, you can do what you want, but remember, a decree of the king cannot be revoked. So they have to be very tricky. They have to write it in such a way that it doesn't sound like they're really revoking it, just adding something new, and it's not really changing it. Now, what is the idea? Why would you have such a rule? Think now, you're emperor, you have a gigantic kingdom. Why would you want to have a rule that an order of the king cannot be revoked?
Well, he's never wrong.
No.
Because he can always deceive them.
You're not thinking practically. Think now practically. Think about running a kingdom. Thinking
of.
Oh, it's going to take 2 months to get there. Okay, with the fastest horses that came out, I think it was like 6 weeks to get there. Just imagine. An order comes from the king, and you are on the end of the kingdom, and the thing gets there 6 weeks, and somebody says, how do you know it's still valid? Maybe he changed his mind. You'll be in trouble, you know, if he changed his mind, and you do it, it will be terrible. You could never have order in a kingdom if it was possible to take back a law that was sent out. You'd never know what to trust and what not to trust. Therefore, you must have a rule. See how practical this is. This is very realistic. Today, with communications, it's not a problem. But in those days, you couldn't handle that. So once he says, that's why, Haman knows, once he gets the seal in and the runners are out with the thing, it's over. It can't be taken back because of the rule of the kingdom.
That's probably also why he's so explicit in what he's saying. So it can't, to the greatest extent that he makes possible, it can't be.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Good progress. Now, Mordechai knew what happened. And he tore his clothes, and he put on sackcloth and ashes. And he went out in the midst of the city, and he yelled a great scream. And he came up to the gate of the king, but you can't come into the gate of the king dressed in sackcloth. That's the rule. And indeed, in every place where the rule, where the word of the king and his law arrived, was great mourning for the Jews, and fasting and crying, and misbeit really means wailing, he says. Misbeit really means a funeral oration, you know, a eulogy. Sackcloth and ashes were, most of them anyway, the great many of them were lying in sackcloth and ashes. Now, this is quite interesting because it was supposed to be secret. So either somehow it leaked out, or somebody bribed somebody, or, you know, these things do happen. So, I hope we can do this. Yeah, we can do it. Esther's maids and chamberlains, servants, advisors came, told her that Mordechai was behaving in this way, and she was very distressed. And she sent clothes to Mordechai to put on, and to take off his sackcloth. And he didn't receive them. Now what is she doing? Well, she's listening, you know. Did you read the fashion magazines this week, this month? Sackcloth and ashes, that's not in this month. Take off that stuff. Look like a mensch. What does she want? She wants him to come into the palace and tell her what's going on. So he sends her. She sends him clothes. You know, look, come on. This is a disaster. Something terrible is happening. Tell me and, you know, we'll work together. And he doesn't do it.
He said he doesn't receive them.
Why
didn't
you say so?
Didn't accept. Sorry?
David
said
so that he might take off
his wife and
pass
her
anyway.
I don't understand your question. Say it again.
David said that so that he might...
Yes, they should take off his sackcloth and ashes. He take off his sackcloth so that he can come in and talk to her. No, so might here doesn't. It means that he should. You know, she gave him this other clothing. Take off your sackcloth. Come in and tell me what's going on. And he doesn't receive it. He won't accept it. So, I mean, her servants come back to her and say he's not taking it. I suppose there was some way to do it.
The other way was to keep it covert.
Or maybe he didn't. Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, the point, she wants to talk to him about it. She wants to interview him about it. And he's not willing to do that. So Esther calls one of her trusted helpers. And someone who the king assigned to her. She commands to Mordechai to know. Maze the Almaze. Now this, Ron Eiselman explains, means two things. Maze means, what is this? What does this mean? What are the forces that are arrayed against us? What is this disaster? Who are our enemies? What powers do they have? What weaknesses do they have? What allies do we have? What strategies can we use? What type of danger is facing us? In other words, what we call a naturalistic description of the danger. The Almaze means, what is this for? What is its ultimate reason? I want to know, in terms of divine providence, what the dynamics are here. It's very important that she asks for both. On the one hand, of course, just knowing the natural situation, from our point of view, would be suicide. If you don't know what God wants, if you don't know what providence wants, then you're already lost. But on the other hand, knowing what providence wants is also not enough. You have to know what's going on the ground. Because you're going to have to deal with what's happening on the ground. And what's happening on the ground is often the key factor that tells you what the divine providence wants. So you have to know both. So he goes out to Mordechai, to the street of the city, or the Rehob could be the street. And, which is before the gates, the king's gate. And he tells Mordechai. He was right outside, but he was just up to the point where he could come before the law says in sackcloth you can't come any further. Okay, maybe, I don't know. Mordechai tells him everything that happened, and he shows him the copy of the writing, which, I skipped a line here. No, he tells him everything that happened, and he tells him the offer that Haman made to give a bribe to Ahasuerus to destroy the Jews. And the copy of the writing he showed to him, which was given in Shushan to destroy them, gave it to him, Mordechai gave it to him, the messenger, to show to Esther, and to tell her, and to command her, to come to the king, to plead with him, and beg from him for her people. Okay, so now he's obtained a copy of the real letter. The letter that says the Jews have to be destroyed. He gives it, tells the messenger, show it to Esther. I understand that. Why does he bother telling her about the bribe? The unsuccessful bribe. Who needs to know that? What did Esther ask? Who are the forces against us? Who are our allies? What means do we have? Mordechai is sending a message. There's nothing we can do. The king didn't even take a bribe to do what he wants to do. What are you going to do? Raise money and buy him off? You can't even buy him off to kill us, let alone you got to buy him off to save us. Don't even think of that. It's not possible. So the servant comes to Esther and he tells her the words of Mordechai. Now Esther says to the servant and commands it to Mordechai, tell the Mordechai the following. All the servants of the king and the peoples of all the provinces of the king know that any man or woman who comes to the king when he's in the inner courtyard, who is not called beforehand, the law is to kill such a person, except for the one to whom the king will stretch out the golden scepter, then he can live. And I have not been called to the king, to come to the king for 30 days. What is Esther saying here? Esther saying a very reasonable argument. What do you want me to do? Plead for the king to change his mind and not kill the Jews. We want a special favor from the king. Well, I haven't been called for 30 days. Why hasn't he called me? Maybe he's out of sorts. You know, he doesn't like me. I've done something to anger him and he's upset with me. Is that the time to go in and ask for a favor when he doesn't like you? Or no? He's just preoccupied with affairs of state and he's in the inner courtyard and doesn't want to be disturbed. And there's a law that says you barge in there, off with your head. Unless he happens to grant you mercy. Is that a good way to go in and ask for a special favor? To violate the law and to have to need his mercy just to stay alive and then say, now that you've given me the mercy of staying alive, please do me a great favor. Is that reasonable, Mordechai, for me to go in now? Furthermore, it could very well be that she is adding to the idea that the decree is for 11 months from now. The decree is for 11 months from now. So, okay, let's wait. Let's wait until he calls me, till he wants me. And then I can maneuver. We've got 11 months. What's the rush? Okay. That's her argument. Frankly, if I put it that way, sounds like a pretty good argument. Now watch Mordechai's response. Mordechai's response is really astonishing. They told Mordechai the words of Esther. Mordechai said to answer Esther, don't believe in your soul that you will escape in the house of the king from the fate of all the Jews. For if you are silent at this time, salvation will stand for the Jews from some other place. And you and your father's house will be destroyed and lost. And who knows if it was not just for a time like this that you became queen, that you arrived at kingdom. Now, I think it's very difficult to imagine that this is Mordechai's claim. That he really suspects that she doesn't care what's going to happen to the Jews, and she's content to be anonymous in the palace. She's managed to keep her identity a secret for years. And she'll just watch the Jews go down the drain, and I'm sure she's protected, so what is it to me that all the Jews die? That is a very extravagant, very exaggerated picture of any fault that Esther might have. But what fault is there here at all? Think now what I told you. Didn't Esther miss something crucial here? Didn't she miss something? Didn't Mordechai send her a signal, and she just flubbed it? She's saying, what's your rush? We have 11 months. I haven't been called in 30 days. Surely he'll want me in a short time. That's the time to go in. Why do I have to go in now? Did he send her any signal that there's a big rush?
Refusing the clothes.
He refused to take the clothes, to come in and talk to her. Why? He's giving her all the information now. It's not that he's keeping anything a secret. But he's saying, I can't stop davening and crying and doing tshuva for even a half hour it will take me to come in and talk to you. So I'm not coming in. And she says, let's wait a week or a month, we've got plenty of time. She missed it. She missed the signal that he sent her. So he says, how could that be? That you missed a signal which is really pretty clear. Because you're a little cut off. You're a little cut off. Your sensitivity to what's happening to the Jewish people is not as tight, not as strong, not as focused as it ought to be. And therefore you missed it. And I'm telling you, that this is what this is the danger that you are running. To be cut off, not to be sensitive to what's going on, is running a terrible danger. And therefore I tell you, you must go in right away. Now, watch what happens. I definitely want to finish this now because there's a balance here that I have to get. Okay, so, 15. She says to say back to Mordechai. All right, you say we have to go in, and I have to appeal to him now. Go and gather all the Jews that are in this city of Shushan. Fast for me. Don't eat and don't drink for 3 days and nights. And I and my maidens will do the same. We'll also fast. And then I will come to the king against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I destroy it, I'm destroyed. Now, what day is this happening on? Well, this is really the 13th, right? So the 13th of Nisan. So the 3 days that they're going to fast are the 14th, the 15th, and the 16th. The 15th is Pesach. 15th of Nisan is Pesach. So she is suggesting that they should fast on Pesach, which means no matzah. You're not going to do the mitzvah of matzah that year. What's the next word in the Megillah? Vayavor Mordechai. Mordechai crossed over. Okay, they say left. But Vayavor means to cross over. Cross over what? What did he cross over? One of the commentators says that that there was a moat around the area of the palace, and he had to cross over the moat to get to the rest of the city. Oshkener Shalom. I mean, why would the Megillah bother to tell me that? So the commentators say like this. At this point, Mordechai balks. And Mordechai says, you're proposing that we should fast on the Seder? Not do the mitzvah of matzah? How are we going to gain God's favor by breaking one of his mitzvahs? Surely that's not the way to do it. He can't take it. He loses his focus at this point. The Medrash explains her point of view. She says to him, and if the Jewish people are wiped out, who's going to eat matzah next year? There won't be any Jews next year. And it says, Vayavar Mordechai, he crossed over, means he crossed over his judgment. He crossed over his own judgment, his own evaluation, and did exactly as Esther commanded him. Now what you see here is an equality, indeed a symmetry, between Mordechai and Esther. And if they're husband and wife, it's even better. So one day it says they're husband and wife. She misses the signal. He commands her. Says he commands her that she has to go in. He can't take the strategy. He loses his focus when it comes to the strategy. He loses. He can't see it. He can't see it as a strategy. He sees that as a mistake. You can't get God's favor by violating his law. And she says you're making a mistake. If it's so crucial, if it's so drastic, if it's something that has to be done now without any possible delay, then we have to use every possible measure. Fasting at Shuva is the greatest measure that we have. We can't communicate with the rest of the Jews in the kingdom, have to start tomorrow, but in the ones in Shushan, we certainly can do it. And it says that he accepts it from her and does as she commands him. What you see here is a man and a woman, each of whom makes a mistake, each of whom has a blind spot, each of whom misses an important fact, and the other one fills it in, and because each is attuned to the other, each one receives what the other one commands. The words here are very strong. She commanded him to do it. And he accepts it. He commanded her to go in, and she accepts it. And had it not been for the willingness of each to receive the judgment and the position of the other, it wouldn't have happened. Each one had to be sensitive to his own possible lack and the fact that the correct view could come from the other. It's a beautiful chapter to learn with people who are worried about how men and women should relate to one another.